From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There is a contingent out there of researchers and enthusiasts who are determined to resurrect certain animals who are long gone. Some you've heard of, some you haven't. A wild ox that went extinct in the 17th century, a hen that disappeared in 1932, a tiger, a parakeet, a frog. The woolly mammoth and the passenger pigeon are the most well-known creatures who are part of these efforts, and technically, on paper, it may be possible through some cloning or some tweaking of certain genes to actually recreate an animal that looks like a mammoth. Today in the program, we're talking about these efforts, the people who are trying to make this happen, and the techniques to do it. But we're also asking the other questions that come along. Are these reassembled creatures the real thing, and just how would they fit in a modern ecosystem? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So you've got to admit, it's kind of exciting to imagine the possibility that we may have the technology to recreate a species that went extinct, a woolly mammoth or a passenger pigeon or a California grizzly. We'll talk about this a little bit later, but it's already been done, actually, with a subspecies of wild goat. The project didn't work so well, but the efforts continue to mesh these bits of old fraying DNA with a base stock of the closest living version of the animal. So conceivably, it may be possible to do this, but there's also the question of whether we should. Today in the program, we're talking about these efforts, about the people who are trying to make this happen and the techniques they're using, but also the other questions. How could these creatures fit in the modern world? Nathaniel Rich is a novelist and essayist. He wrote the article, The Mammoth Cometh, for the February 27th edition of the New York Times Magazine. I should also say his latest novel is called Odds Against Tomorrow, and Nathaniel Rich is joining us today from a studio in New Orleans. And Nathaniel Rich, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We also have with us Brian Switek. He's a freelance science writer based here in Salt Lake City. Blogs about paleontology for National Geographic. He wrote about de-extinction last year. His latest book is called My Beloved Brontosaurus. And Brian Switek, welcome back. Thanks for having me here. Well, Nathaniel Rich, I want to begin with you. And I want to begin with one of the characters in the story because I think he helps us sort of understand the people who are thinking about all of this. So let's start with Ben Novak. You start your article with Ben, who saw a passenger pigeon when he was 16 and it just knocked him out.
Yeah, he fell to his knees on the floor of a science museum in Minneapolis and stayed there motionless for about 20 minutes and just sat there regarding the birds in awe. And really, his attitude hasn't changed since then. He's now, I believe, 27, and this is his life's work, bringing back the passenger pigeon.
Is it a kind of obsession? I mean, he goes around the country visiting these stuffed passenger pigeons. I mean, he's obsessed in some way.
It's unquestionably an obsession. Yeah. I tend to be drawn to obsessives, and right. Once I read about him, I knew he was a man for me. I don't think I included this in the piece, but it's his goal to see every single stuffed passenger pigeon in the world. There's about 1,500 or 1,600 of them. He's seen, last I checked with him, about 390. But yeah, he's obsessed with the pigeon to a degree that even baffles colleagues of his in the lab where they're doing the genome sequencing of the bird. So he goes above and beyond, I think, most people even in this field.
Well, this comes up a little bit later when we talk about the science, but there was some question raised. I mean, he's been trying to get involved in the science of all of this, but he suffered some rejection due to the fact that people are a little worried, at least one person was, that he's a little too zealous.
Yeah, I think that is a concern. It's a concern someone like Beth Shapiro, who runs the lab at UCSC, the paleogenomics lab there. She rejected him when he applied to work with her the first time. He then got a place in the lab once the Revive and Restore project was underway, which was funded by Stuart Brand and other people. But I've heard since the piece that he's now been accepted to begin a master's program there. So he's on his way. But I think all scientists tend to be suspicious of anybody who carries too much emotion into the lab. I think Ben tries to restrain himself, but it's not always so easy.
Yeah. So another, you mentioned Stuart Brand. He's another figure that plays a part in this story, founder of the Whole Earth Catalog. And he's kind of excited about all of this too.
Yeah, he's just an exciting guy. I got to spend about a week with him in San Francisco and in his office in Sausalito when I reported the piece. And his enthusiasm is really infectious. And, you know, among the different arguments that he and others make for de-extinction is the argument that, you know, no matter what ultimate success it has, whether it's you know, returning a couple birds who die quickly, as in the case of the Bucardo that you mentioned, or if it's bringing billions of passenger pigeons back to the planet and woolly mammoths and so on, the most valuable part of this is symbolic, that it's giving people a story, environmental story, to root for instead of the dreary news that we get on a daily basis, really. And so it's a way to bring optimism to the challenges that are facing us and facing our own species.
Mm. So you point out in the article, I think it was 3 years ago, Stuart Brand invites this man named Tim Flannery to speak at the seminar that he holds. He has these seminars that talk about these really big, scientific, ambitious ideas. And this is where this idea of resurrecting extinct species really takes hold for Brand, I guess. Tell us that part of the story where Stuart Brand into it.
Yeah, Tim Flannery, who's one of the best writers we have about the environment and is an activist, also an Australian, gave a speech about mass extinction, the idea that we've engineered our climate in such a way that we're driving tens of thousands or more species extinct every single year, which would align us with one of the six great – it would be the sixth great mass extinction in the planet's history. And in the course of that very depressing talk and in the Q&A that followed, Brand said, well, what if we could bring some of these species back? And Tim Flannery said, well, that's a pretty good idea. And that's sort of how Brand's mind works. So he got – you know, he called up some friends the next day, included E.O. Wilson, perhaps the world's most distinguished biologist at Harvard. And he called up George Church, who's the person at MIT who's sort of the E.O. Wilson of the genetics world, and who's working on technologies that can make this type of thing possible. And he sent them an email saying, you know, essentially, can we do this? I think it would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
And George Church responded within a couple hours saying, yeah, this is how it's going to happen. And he laid out basically a five-step process, and they've been going ever since.
Yeah. It's interesting what he writes, Brand, in that email to George Church and E.O. Wilson. I wanted to quote it because he sort of – the point that he makes I think is worth talking about. He says this. He says, the environmental and conservation movements have mired themselves in a tragic view of life. The return of the passenger pigeon could shake them out of it. So this is a conservation argument as much as anything for him. He's like, we can change people's minds.
Yeah, this argument comes from conservation. That's how Brand tries to put it. Whether or not you think that the conservation argument that, you know, that bringing back these species will be ecologically beneficial, whether that is what convinces you, whether or not you find that convincing is another question.
Right.
But that's the argument that they advance, and there's some truth to it. I mean, there's the symbolic power of it, which we discussed, that maybe it brings attention and perhaps funding to a field that gets very little of it, or perhaps bringing back species like the mammoth. If you put the mammoth in the Arctic, George Church holds a theory that's not accepted everywhere, but he holds a theory that through their grazing patterns, they would help protect the permafrost, which is significant on a global level, since the permafrost captures, I think, something like two or three times the amount of carbon that is in the entire Amazonian rainforest. So that could have a kind of, you know, it's a kind of trickle up, I suppose, conservation effect. Same with the birds, could help a number of different woodland species. But ultimately, I think that the coolness of the technology, I mean, that's the term that scientists use, the cool, that it's cool.
Yeah.
I think that will ultimately carry the day. I mean, essentially, if you look at the history of civilization, there's really no technology that people liked that was banned successfully by any government or state, at least for a significant period of time.
I want to, Brian Sweetek, I want to bring you into the conversation because it's this idea that a lot of conservationists mention that bothers you a bit. This idea that we're going to restore this balance, that, you know, we've screwed things up as a species ourselves. So we have this obligation to fix what we've messed up, you know, restore a balance that we've thrown off kilter. This really bothers you. I mean, you point out in your piece for the National Geographic, there is no such thing as the balance of nature. Do you want to give us a sense of where you're coming from?
Yeah, sure. I went to a TED Talk conference about this time last year that National Geographic and TEDx held about de-extinction. And, you know, I was sitting there watching this, waiting to sort of be convinced. The thing that really struck me about, you know, this ongoing process, it isn't really the resurrection of species. We're not getting the woolly mammoth or the passenger pigeon as it once was. We're getting a reinvented sort of version, our best guess at what these animals are like. So it's almost this paradox in the way that this is being approached, and that we're going back to a time that's long gone, whether that's, you know, the beginning of the 20th century or the last ice age or however far back that you want to go. But at the same time, we're sort of engineering something that's never been seen before. It's actually novel. So you have this great symbolism, as, you know, as we just mentioned, of, you know, recreating these species that have been lost. But at the same time, that symbolism is not the best reflection, I guess, of what is actually going on, what the actual consequences of this might be. I mean, imagining billions of passenger pigeons are not going to be flying through sort of unfettered American chestnut forests like they used to. They're going to be dropping guano on, you know, suburban neighborhoods. You're going to get calls from the local you know, community heads saying, what are we going to do about these birds? So, I mean, that's a whole other sort of issue coming out of this. But, yeah, that it's actually – you have the symbol of going back, restoring what's lost, but it's actually inventing something new.
And more broadly, I mean, you really resist this idea about the goodness of nature, that there's some purity that we can return to.
Yeah, I think that sort of imagery has ruled ecology for a long time, and that's a classic sort of mid-20th century Silent Spring, Aldo Leopold sort of look at it. And there's a sort of new movement fomenting in ecology now that you find nature where it is, and we're a part of it, and we're influencing it. And especially trying to go back kind of seems muddle-headed in a way. I mean, if you think about just global climate change alone, the global climate by the end of this century is going to be about 11.5 degrees Fahrenheit higher than it is now. You engineer woolly mammoth, if you put it back in the Arctic, there might not be any Arctic anymore. So if you want to make a mammoth or an elephant or something like that, that will be able to adapt and evolve, or, you know, heat-resistant woolly mammoth, as odd as that sounds, that would make a bit more sense to me than saying, let's go back 12,000 years or 20,000 years to something that doesn't exist anymore.
Nathaniel Rich, we're going to talk about sort of the technical parts and the ethical questions too, but is this how the debate is playing out as you're seeing it?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I think I agree with a lot of what Brian says and come from the same place intellectually. But, you know, we do have heat-resistant woolly mammoths. They're elephants, right? And that's what they're trying to engineer into woolly mammoths, is they're trying to make them cold-resistant. And I also think that the de-extinction people, at least those that I interviewed for the article, are very much of a mind with what Brian was saying, that there is no stable version of nature that we can go back to, that nature is always changing, and especially since human beings arrived on the continent. And so the idea is not so much obviously there's a nostalgic element to it, but when they really talk about the actual scenarios that they're planning, the idea is really to introduce greater level of biodiversity into the ecosystem. Now, you could argue that introducing one species of bird or 10 species of birds and other animals is not going to have a greatly significant effect. I think that's a valid argument. But at the same time, I think their idea is just to try to increase biodiversity and also to help species that are struggling now by using genetic measures, by engineering species to survive the changing climate. So for instance, with a mammoth or an elephant, it's very much of a piece with what they're doing, this idea of genetically altering animals in order to help them to adapt to a changing climate.
I wanted to ask you about I want to get into the particulars of how this possibly could work. We made a reference to the fact that that this has been done before. This the Bucardo, this mountain goat that went extinct in 2000. They went through this process. It was – and this was a – I guess this was a cloning process, this one, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a form of cloning.
Form
interspecies.
Of cloning. Yeah. And it didn't work so well. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. It after about 57 goats were implanted with this genetically altered embryo, one of them brought the egg to term and gave birth to a Bucardo. So it was a different species, a different type of mountain goat giving birth to this species. And it survived about 9 minutes. It had a lung deformity and it basically choked to death. That was 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago. Right. And the scientist who led that project has just gotten clearance to start it again. But it obviously it highlights one of the big issues with this type of work and with cloning in general, which is that the way the technology is currently, although I imagine it's constantly improving to some degree, you will have pain and suffering for animals. But you know, Stuart Brand makes a utilitarian argument that isn't a little pain now worth bringing back an entire species and theoretically millions of other beings that would never have seen the light of day otherwise.
Hmm. So that's the cloning method. But the other process you mentioned is it's even more complicated because
yeah.
DNA begins, as we all know, to decay as soon as an organism dies.
It's very complicated and it took a couple thousand words to explain it in the piece. But right. Yeah, essentially, what they're doing is they first have to map the DNA of the species that's extinct. So they'll use literally a museum sample from a natural history museum.
Yeah.
And will have a imperfect map or blueprint, and they'll compare that with the genome of the species that resembles it most closely genetically, in evolution, evolutionary terms.
Yeah.
And so with the pigeon, the passenger pigeon, it's the band-tailed pigeon. So then they basically create using the other genome as a guide what they think to be the definitive version of this extinct species genome. But of course they can't be exact because we don't have the full genome of the dead species because the DNA is degraded. And then from there they start to take cells from the living species that we do have and genetically engineer it until its genome matches that blueprint that they've put together on their computers. That they think is the passenger pigeon. At that point, they can then implant the cells into an embryo, and a similar process ensues where the new species is giving birth to this old species, or a simulacrum of the old species,
yeah, right,
or some new version of it, as Brian pointed out.
How far away are we from a working passenger pigeon genome? I mean, it's really complicated. Are we even close?
Well, they have one.
They
have one right now. They are not they're not publishing it yet, but they think Beth Shapiro wants to publish their genome in time for the 100th anniversary of the death of the last known passenger pigeon in captivity named Martha. Right. I think that's in
September. Yeah.
And so they're currently comparing – they're doing some sequencing of the band-tailed pigeon still in the hope of kind of improving what they have. They've already sequenced the rock pigeon, which is the common pigeon you see on sidewalks in every city. And so that got them pretty close. They're doing the band-tailed pigeon now. And so they'll publish something. They'll publish a genome, you know, by the end of the year, and that's what they'll work with. Now, whether that is, you know, an exact replication of what the passenger pigeon genome was, it's almost impossible to know with 100% assurance. But you could also say that, you know, you could also point out that every single bird has its own genome. So there's no really one definitive genome. But they'll be confident that they're pretty close by then.
Mm. Brian, what do you make of that? I mean, there's sort of genetic tinkering that's going to happen. It's complicated, this process. So it's sort of fine-tuning as we go, tinkering. As we go, there's sort of an ecological tinkering that has to come to play too, which I want to talk about a little bit later. But there's sort of this genetic part. What do you make about this this process?
Yeah, it's sort of a black box in a way. I mean, and this is part of what Nathaniel mentioned about the cool factor of this. You were talking about DNA and genes and sort of extract, especially when you get into Ice Age stuff, extracting DNA from these long-lost animals and reassembling their genome for the first time in, you know, thousands of years or in decades. But genes aren't everything about a species. You know, there's a sort of, I think, impression, whether it's intentional or unintentional, it's being given that, okay, we have the passenger pigeon genome. We've reconstructed it as best we can. And therefore, it's going to act and it's going to do what a passenger pigeon does. But that's not necessarily so. I mean, there are genes that regulate behavior, but behavior is also passed down. It also has to do with generations passing on behaviors to the next one.
So this is the nature-nurture argument, which we haven't figured out really, right? Or
yeah, I mean, there's no bird that flocks quite like they do today. So I mean, it could be that you wind up with a passenger pigeon that doesn't quite act like a passenger pigeon. Then you have to figure out, how do we teach this bird to actually do it? And it's sort of nature and nurture both. It's not sort of one overriding the other, but you need both intertwined. So really, you know, putting the genome together and then figuring out the cloning and getting the animal is just the first half of this, you know, grand experiment.
Doesn't Nathaniel, which doesn't Ben Novak say, well, right, it's going to take – in fact, he says it'll take 25 years for us to sort of figure this out. At some point, though, we will. At least he seems to think, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think he agrees that this stuff is very difficult. But we do – you know, and we do have accounts of their behavior. We know some big things about them. There are tons of – you know, Audubon wrote a fascinating chapter about the bird, although some of the details later turned out to be erroneous. And that's the problem. They weren't really studied by scientists in a serious way, certainly not as they would today. The way Ben talks about it is he tends to reduce their function he tends to talk about how they function on the level of the ecosystem, right? So what do they do for the ecosystem? You know, they flock in big numbers. They eat certain type of mast. They migrate in a slightly unusual way in that they have no set migration. And there are a few other characteristics like that that all serve roles within the ecology of a forest and of a continent. And so his goal is to create a bird that does all of those big things well and does them in the same way that we know passenger pigeons did. Now, are the little things going to be the same? You know, all the little genes that we have no idea, you know, at this point what they are about – you know, duration of sleep or instincts about, you know, hunger or even more mundane things that I can't think of on the spot and because I'm not a bird specialist, you know, we won't have those things. And so in those other categories, this bird might be very divergent. But they will be satisfied if on a sort of large ecological scale, this bird serves the same function in the ecosystem that the passenger pigeon did.
It's Nathaniel Rich. He wrote the article "The Mammoth Cometh" for the February 27th edition of the New York Times Magazine. There's a link to it on our website. His latest novel is called Odds Against Tomorrow. He's joining us from New Orleans. We have Brian Switek here in the studio, freelance science writer based in Salt Lake City, blogs for National Geographic. He wrote the article "Reinventing the Mammoth" last year that dealt with this. We need to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring this question. What if you could bring back an extinct species? If you saw Jurassic Park, you know kind of how it works, theoretically anyway. You need some DNA. And there are researchers and environmentalists who are exploring how you would combine the DNA of lost species with their living relatives, woolly mammoths, passenger pigeons. Part of the reasoning is that for all the damage humans have done to the planet, we should at least give it a shot. But should we? That's part of the question and raised in an article by Nathaniel Rich and another article by Brian Switek. Nathaniel Rich is a novelist and essayist. He wrote the article "The Mammoth Cometh" for the New York Times Magazine. He's joining us from New Orleans. Brian Switek joining us here in the studio. He blogs for National Geographic. His article is called "Reinventing the Mammoth." wrote that last year. So I wanted to talk about the mammoth. There is because Nathaniel Ritchie write about this. I thought it sounded, I have to say, kind of fascinating, a little fantastical. But there's this Russian scientist, Sergei Zimov, who wants to actually create a preserve in Siberia for these resurrected mammoths.
Yeah, he's created it. It's called Pleistocene Park, and he's filling it with lots of big mammals. And he would be thrilled to add the woolly mammoth to the mix.
What is the – I mean, we talked about passenger pigeons. What about – what do we know about mammoths? George Church, you point out, believes there's – that we have enough – we know enough about the mammoth genome to do this. I mean, is it conceivable, this?
Well, the mammoth in some ways is – we're a lot closer than the passenger pigeon, and it's a lot – easier, in part because of global warming and the melting of the Arctic. Mammoths are coming to life, to light every day. Yes. Not every day, often enough that hunters up there use mammoth meat as dog food. They hack it off of the bones when they find it when they melt. So that there is some hope still that they can find. Living or frozen sperm cells. I think this is one of the more far-fetched ideas in one of these mammoths, and use that directly to create a new mammoth. But they have a number of different methods and strategies about how to bring these mammoths back. What seems to be the most likely scenario is that they will introduce some genetic changes into the genome of the Asian elephant, which is probably the closest species genetically to the mammoth. And what they will do is allow it to grow hair and develop a layer of subcutaneous fat so that it can withstand cold weather. And then they would put that new animal into the Arctic and presumably call it a woolly mammoth.
Yeah. Brian, what do you think about that? Do you find that cool?
Oh, I would love to see a woolly mammoth. I mean, we're sitting here in the Bonneville shoreline. You know, I can look and see where mammoths used to roam. I mean, that would be one of the most adorable things ever. You think baby sloths are cute? You know, baby mammoths would shoot right to the top of the internet meme list. The thing about mammoths, though, is that we don't actually know as much about them as we'd like, in some ways even less than passenger pigeons. We've got cave paintings from La Chaux in France and a few other places. But even though we've got all these bodies and we've got all these bones, there's still quite a bit we don't know about how they actually lived, and even if we were responsible for their extinction. So one of the sort of selling points for this kind of de-extinction is that humans were heavily involved in the end Ice Age extinctions, the one that and we're sort of continuing today, but that wiped out the saber-toothed cats, the dire wolves, woolly mammoths, giant ground sloths, all that sort of stuff. And in places like the American Midwest, where you get woolly mammoth bodies, you know, sometimes one in every lake, more or less, it seems, there's no unambiguous evidence of sort of human interaction. There are some kill sites around the world, but not as many as would be expected. So we might have had something to do with it. We may not have. So that sort of almost guilt trip argument is kind of up in the air to start with, not to mention that just in terms of their biology, we still don't know a great deal about how they're feeding, even how many species there were. There's a sort of new hypothesis that woolly mammoths and another species that live further to the south called the Columbia mammoth were actually the same one, that you had one highly variable species instead of split species. So we don't even actually have a good baseline for what a woolly mammoth is. And I guess that gets to my sort of not complaint, but in some ways I feel more extreme than some of the de-extinction people on that. Rather than bring back a woolly mammoth, why not say, okay, we've got the Arctic. It's going to keep getting warmer. It's going to keep changing. Why not engineer an elephant that'll survive there and change the habitat in such and such a way, rather than going back and trying to sort of recreate that something that we don't even fully understand yet?
But Nathaniel Rich writes about this in his in his article. Who cares what you call it? I mean, the point is, if you add new animals, whatever you call them, however you market them, if you add them into an ecosystem, it just makes the ecosystem, or should, if you do it right anyway, if you put them in the proper sort of environments, I suppose, in the proper context, then it just makes it a richer ecosystem. So who cares what you call it?
Yeah, I guess that I would agree with that. I would say why not sort of drop the marketing in a way. I think it has a lot to do with.
So is it Nathaniel a semantic? Is it a semantic argument in some way for you?
In some ways, but I think it would be better to go even further. So another example of this sort of moving back from the woolly mammoth just for a moment would be a white nose syndrome. So it's this sort of fungal infection that's devastating bats all across North America. And there was some discussion of this at the De-Extinction Conference that I attended, saying, well, why not either engineer bats to be resistant or even engineer the fungus to not infect bats anymore? And that's the sort of application that I think is even more fascinating and they'd like to see. I mean, a woolly mammoth or a passenger pigeon or a Tasmanian tiger or whatever extinct species you pick might be a good symbol. But the thing that I'm not seeing that quite the connection for yet, or the thing that really is going to be important about all this, is the ways that we can use these technologies to then engineer animals and engineer ecosystems in such a way to be healthier and to be richer. So in some ways it's semantic. In some ways I just want that symbol to be there so we can get to the really cool and important conservation work that sort of lays behind that.
What do you think, Nathaniel Rich? I mean, you write about this, you know, that this idea of sort of tinkering with the genetics of animals, this is where we're headed, I guess.
Yeah, and this is where we already are. I mean, this is the type of work that Revive and Restore is actually probably going to be doing most aggressively. That's Stuart Brand's group. I mean, the passenger pigeon and, of course, the woolly mammoth are the figureheads. But frankly, it's a lot easier to introduce one genetic change into a species to make them, you know, resistant, for instance, to the white nose fungus than it is to create synthetically a whole new animal. So while I think they'll have these larger symbolic projects that will go on for many years, there will probably be a lot more projects like the ones that Brian was describing and help. It's called facilitated adaptation is the term that's used. And it already happens using different methods. It happens with breeding with some endangered species, for instance, hybridization. There was a project in Florida with the jaguars there where they introduced a different, I think, subspecies of jaguar to breed jaguars that could withstand various environmental stresses better. What's changed now is the tool. So now they can do these things in a petri dish instead of have to rely on animals mating.
What do you think about the scope of all of this? I want to get both of your opinion. Nathaniel, you first. The fact that we can go in and do all this engineering, on one hand, could be incredibly helpful, but it also seems, I'll use a word, unnatural. I mean, what do you make of that? Nathaniel Ritchie first.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a there's sort of an undertone of the Island of Dr. Moreau or right. Dr. Mengele or something.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
And yes, of course, these technologies can be used in horrific ways, but the ways that they can be used are, you know, there are things that can be done with, you know, biological warfare that are far scarier than anything we might be able to do with a pigeon, and which we could then ultimately kill if everything goes wrong. I mean, that's part of the idea is if we make some kind of horrific mistake, then we can kill the birds or the mammoths. We've done it before. Yeah, it's a little bit scary at first blush, but really, if you study the history of civilization and the way that we've interacted and controlled nature or tried to, what's really changing is the tools. And you know, we've had hybridization, we've had breeding, we've had pollination for centuries and millennia. We're now just getting a lot better, a lot more surgical, a lot more precise. And what we can do is a lot more impressive. And frankly, this stuff with bringing back species, different animals, is really just the tip of the iceberg and is the application of this science, synthetic biology, that's most comprehensible, I think, to most people because everyone knows what a woolly mammoth is and everyone thinks it's kind of cool to bring it back. But there will be much more far-reaching applications of this type of science in human medicine and agriculture and in a lot of other type of bioengineering fields. So this is really just the start, and I think what's important is that we do it well. We think about it in a serious way, and sooner than later, I think everyone will be comfortable with it, even if they don't realize that they are.
Well, you write about this, Brian, so we take this so-called purity argument, mm-hmm. that you have these people who are resistant to this de-extinction idea because it doesn't seem natural. I mean, Kent Redford, this ecologist, mentioned that there, people have this cultural obsession with natural purity.
That's right. You can see it at Whole Foods, of all places. You know, and this plays into what's going on with GMOs, with people being against vaccinations for their children. It feeds into the general distrust of science, and that if you're manipulating anything in this sort of way, then it's a Dr. Frankenstein kind of situation. When really it's this going from analog to digital. I mean, Nathaniel just said we've been doing this in terms of hybridization, creating new crops and stuff like that. Like, go and find a natural banana and see how it compares to the one that you get at the grocery store, and you'll see how much we've done just sort of by hand over the centuries. Now this is entering this new era with a lot more possibilities, but that's the scary thing. It sort of feeds into all this sort of mad scientist propaganda in a way that makes it frightening, especially sci-fi channel is sort of making its living off playing movies about zombie mammoths and saber-toothed cats brought back from the dead, and we've all seen Jurassic Park and the sort of even that movie facile argument of, thinking whether we could do it rather than we should do it.
Yeah.
So it's sort of trendy in a way to go green and go natural and think that any sort of manipulation of that is wrong, when in fact we've been introducing invasive species for our entire career as a species. We're either intentionally or unintentionally changing the global climate. We're already making these changes and delimiting boundaries, deciding what should exist where. I mean, wolves were just brought back to Yellowstone after being wiped out in the 1990s, and they're still controversial in Montana. I can't even imagine what it would be like if someone brought a woolly mammoth or something out into Montana or elsewhere. So I think that's going to be one of the major challenges of this movement. I mean, we were speaking about marketing and symbolism a little bit before, is getting beyond this sort of green obsession that in some ways is science friendly, but in other ways very, very distrustful of anything that goes on in the lab.
Brian Switek, he is with us. He blogs for National Geographic, wrote a piece last year called Reinventing the Mammoth. Nathaniel Rich, also with us, the novelist and essayist, he wrote The Mammoth Cometh for the New York Times Magazine. His latest book is called Odds Against Tomorrow. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the de-extinction debate, this question of whether we could or should bring back extinct species, whether they are in fact the actual creature itself, or what the implications are for all of this. Nathaniel Rich, novelist, essayist, is joining us. He wrote a piece for the New York Times Magazine called The Mammoth Cometh that deals with all of this. Brian Switek has been thinking about this too. Last year, he also wrote a piece dealing with the same issues. Take a call. From John, who's with us in Salt Lake. John, hi.
Yeah, when I hear about an organism such as a human being living, it's not just our genetic code. It's this incredible accompaniment of other biological organisms inside our body that if you bring back an old species, you haven't brought back the entire support system that allows their digestive system to live as one of the small items.
Brian, you want to take that question?
Yeah, sure. Especially with animals like
the... What do we mean by an organism, basically?
Right,
yeah.
Right. I mean, it's not just a package of genes. I mean, that's sort of getting back to like the selfish gene argument, that we're just kind of these bundles of genes wandering around being regulated by them. But there's certain things that aren't passed down that way, or that have to do with gene expression. So the way the environment brings out certain genes to affect behavior and things of that nature. So especially if you're dealing with an animal that's large and complex and has a family system like we expect woolly mammoths did, who's going to teach a woolly mammoth to be a woolly mammoth? In a way, that's why I've sometimes criticized going back to these extinct species and not just saying, well, we want an elephant that does this in this particular habitat.
Let's make it hairy.
Let's make it hairy for the look of it. Let's make it cuddly. That's a good marketing point. And just do it that way rather than pretending as if this is definite, because we're never really going to know, is the thing. How would we know if we missed that mammoth baseline?
Yeah. Nathaniel, what do you think?
Well, one thing that's really interesting about the whole process of de-extinction is that really no step along the way, starting with the sequencing of the genome and ending with the, you know, behavioral and population biology, nothing is new. This is all each step has been done and to some extent perfected in itself. So for instance, there's a whole field of reintroduction biology, which is introducing endangered species into habitats where they used to exist, like Brian brought up with the wolves, for instance. There's also we know how to use surrogate species as parents for species. That's done in breeding. It's done with pigeons, in fact.
Yeah.
And so all of the questions that come up about each step along the way, I mean, everything's been thought out and perfected by biologists. What's new is that we're stringing it all together with one species from conception to to a large population, ideally. So that's what's new. The science itself along the way is sort of hopscotching between different spheres of types of processes that have already been thought out and are practiced widely.
Yeah, there's a question from Dennis who says, what do we know about how this would change vectors for spreading disease? Nathaniel Rich, you write a little bit about that. There is some concern about disease in this study.
Yeah, that was my concern. I asked every scientist I spoke to about that, and really nobody was very, very anxious about it. I mean, David Hausler, who I interviewed for the piece, is one of the people who ran the Human Genome Project. He's told me that essentially this bird would have no greater risk of spreading disease than any other animal. That of all the problems that could happen, this is one of the smaller ones. And in fact, if something like that did happen, it could be destroyed because they would know where every single bird is. Because part of the process is they ultimately, if this all succeeds, in the best case scenario, they have a huge flock. They'll have microchips in every single bird. They'll know where they are and what they're doing. And so, if there's a big problem, they can wipe them out if they have to.
Back to the phones. Susan is with us in Salt Lake. Susan, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I wonder what the effects are going to be of introducing new animals when on the existing ones, on existing populations. For example, invasive species. We already have, many problems. It seems to me that I wonder how much they think about that, and it seems to me there's a tremendous potential for unintended consequences.
Brian, what do you think? Because, I mean, this question of, there is one constant in terms of evolution, and that is change. Adaptation and change, and we're constantly moving. Maybe at some point we need to say, we've done that, this happened, we need to move on. I mean, this idea, we're worried in Utah about a certain mussel, that's invading Utah lakes. What if you put a California grizzly, a predator that's, apex predator that's gone extinct, or a woolly mammoth or a passenger pigeon for that matter? What happens when you put them into a system right now?
Right. I mean, that's something that's been studied a little bit more intensively right now. It's been something that's known for a while called trophic cascade. So you introduce an animal, especially something like a keystone animal, an animal that literally changes the landscape. So in the case of like a woolly mammoth that would probably, push down trees or graze in such a way that it affects the plant community, it's going to have ripple effects. Is going to change the nature of this community. One hypothesis about the wolves in Yellowstone, for example, is that they scare away elk and other herbivores from these creekside habitats that allow sort of these swamp marshes to be reintroduced. That brings moose in, that brings beaver in. That's a positive example of this kind of cascade, but can also go the other way. That's something that we might not entirely know about until it starts to happen. That's something that really, once these animals, if they are introduced, will have to be carefully monitored, because we don't always know the consequences of what's going to happen. So an example.
What killed mammoths in the past?
Well, people ate them at times, but it seems to be a combination of shifting environments or climate change, the world getting a little bit warmer and a little bit wetter. They're better in cooler,
I don't mean what made them extinct. And on a day-to-day basis.
What killed them.
Yeah. What were the predators?
Well, if you were little, things like saber-toothed cats. So once you got to be a big adult mammoth, there wasn't really very much that could touch you other than disease. And there's not really anything around today that would really fill that predatory niche. And they have to think about, okay, do we want to bring saber-toothed cats back? I'd like to see that debate hit the congressional floor. I can tell you fireworks would fly. But it's something where I just saw a talk by a paleontologist out of San Bernardino named Eric Scott, where he talked about the introduction of bison to North America, this great American symbol that actually came over from Eurasia about a little more than 100,000 years ago, how there's this new hypothesis that they changed the plant community so dramatically that it actually caused some of those big things like mammoths to go extinct, that the food that the bison were eating and also cultivating were sort of causing mammoths and giant ground sloths and things like that to run out of their own food, and this could have hastened sort of their extinction. So if we're thinking about putting species back to where they were or sort of extinct species back, that's the sort of thing that people have to watch out for, things that we might not be able to even think of until it starts happening.
Mm. Nathaniel, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think that's a real concern, and it's something that all of the people who are studying this have, unintended consequences. However, there's a general feeling that the greater amount of biodiversity we have, the more species, the more genes in an ecology, the healthier that ecology is. And we know also that we're at a time of extreme depletion of our environment and of biodiversity. So I think there's some belief that there's a much greater chance of success and of a positive cascade than a negative one. But of course, this is something that they'll be monitoring, and it's something that they study and have studied with other, you know, with invasive species biology and in reintroducing species into environments where they no longer exist.
Yeah. This question often comes up, you know, should we focus all of these resources, all of this energy into this or into the species, the endangered species that remain? That's Megan has a email. She writes, "My concern is that the environmental factors that lead to extinction in the first place are still factors. It doesn't seem like we're taking very good care of the animals that we currently have." Brian Sweetage.
Yeah, to jump in on that real quick, I mean, one of the reasons that some of these extinctions happened in near time were people hunting them into extinction, things like the passenger pigeon and the Tasmanian tiger and other animals. And, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, poaching problems, even with woolly mammoths. We might bring these animals back to just see them show up on the black market immediately. We actually haven't eliminated some of these same extinction pressures that still exist. And there certainly is an argument that I've often heard many ecologists and conservation biologists make that, you know, with the limited money that there is, you know, why spend it on this? I think that's something that hasn't entirely been demonstrated. I think that's a worry. I'm not sure how much of an actual fear that is. If the extinction can inspire people, maybe more money will come in. You know, maybe the funding will come from different sources. But there is that sort of question of why bring these things back if we've got plenty of species sort of deserving of attention now. My hope would be that through de-extinction that scientists would come up with the sort of tools to use on those species that are imperiled now. That's something it's not at the forefront of the debate, but I hope certainly follows.
You know, it's interesting, Nathaniel Rich, you write that there is also this rhetorical threat for conservation biologists, this that you write about. You know, what happens when you remove the specter of extinction? You've removed this really powerful argument. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's the conservationist's trump card, that there's no return from extinction, that it's a kind of death. It's a death that's even greater than an individual death. And if you lose that rhetorically, then you can't send out your mailers about, you know, save the panda or save the wolf, because anyone can retort, well, we can just bring it back tomorrow if we want to. So they're really concerned about that. It's a major fundraising tool, and it's a major political tool. It's a way of shaming politicians into action. And it's worked before, but it hasn't worked well enough. I think any conservation biologist would agree that it's their methods have had limited success, but success is limited. I mean, we're on a downward trajectory still. Species continue to die out at an extremely alarming rate, and so the hope is, as Brian said, that this new field will bring greater attention to the crisis, will bring better science to these problems, and ultimately will bring more money for everybody. That's something that is, of course, debated by conservation biologists who see their life's work in peril as a result of this.
Brian Sweetek, you write in your article that a proxy mammoth would emerge into what you say is a world of government regulations, of public opinion and scientific debate that you say would hinge upon what we value and what we want to protect.
Absolutely. I think this is sort of academic at the moment, you know, how to put this genome together and get that published. It's all sort of background research. But let's say that someone actually creates a woolly mammoth. Where do you put it? And how do you decide who watches over it and whether at what point does the public say, like, we would actually like this animal to be back, especially let's say you live in a certain area of ranchland and we have something a little bit more like the Colombian mammoth that can survive, say, in like Montana or South Dakota or elsewhere. A mammoth comes along and, you know, destroys somebody's crop or kills a couple of their cows or something like that. And you basically at this point have a genetically modified organism, which people are already scared about, coming in, destroying or hindering private property. I can only imagine the outcry about this. And this isn't a reason not to do it, but it's something that I think will have to be very carefully thought through, is at what point do we bring the public in and bring regulatory agencies in and as a community, as you know, a planet, decide whether we want to do this or not. Not to have it be the decision of a handful of scientists, but really to have a real conversation about this and what we want to do with this, the power to bring species back or to manipulate species at a speed and in a way that's never been possible before.
Nathaniel, what do you think about that? Let me give you the final word as we're running out of time here.
Yeah, well, you know, there's already law papers being published about this. There's one paper I cited in my piece called How to Permit Your Mammoth.
Right.
That basically goes into detail about all of these legal and political questions and ends, concludes that, yes, these will have to be governed as I'm paraphrasing, but as human creations, as synthetic creations, not normal animals, in the letter of the law. But ultimately, you know, while this is an important conversation to have, like many other conversations that we've been having about the subject, ultimately the science is going to plow ahead, and we will be left, the rest of us, to respond. And I think we will. But this is happening, and you know, it's already happened. It's going to continue to happen on a larger and larger scale. And I think rather than, you know, cower from it, we have to think about what this means for us, what this means for our species and for our future. And I think while there are some scary elements, I think it's an exciting time.
Nathaniel Rich, his article, The Mammoth Cometh, appeared in the New York Times Magazine. We have a link to it on our website. His latest novel is called Odds Against Tomorrow. He joined us from New Orleans. Nathaniel Rich, thanks.
Thanks a lot for having me. I enjoyed it.
Brian Switek blogs about paleontology for National Geographic. His book, My Beloved Brontosaurus, is now out in paperback. And Brian Switek, thanks to you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you both.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. The program is directed, technical direction from Mike Anderson, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.